From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, we examine the latest NSA allegations that the US and so-called Five Eyes have been secretly collecting data across Asia. We speak to a US soldier who's made it his mission to bring an Afghan interpreter to America.
5 years sigh of relief has finally come out of my body. He's the last member of my unit that was still serving at war, and he's finally done it. Over.
And we hear from the victims of Hurricane Sandy 1 year after the storm devastated the country's east coast. And we head to New York City, where the British graffiti artist Banksy has divided opinion across Manhattan.
He's not from New York. He's not even from the United States. So what happens is that, you know, coming from Europe, I believe that there's still this negative image, stereotypes of the Bronx.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Syria's chemical weapons equipment stockpile has been destroyed, according to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Inspectors from the international watchdog say tools to produce a future arsenal have been destroyed ahead of a Friday deadline, but that Syria must now fulfill its commitment to destroying its remaining chemical weapons. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gapman reports.
Inspectors on the ground in Syria have been locating and destroying Syria's arsenal of deadly chemicals, including nerve gas and sulfur mustard, as well as equipment and facilities used to manufacture chemical weapons. A team from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, were deployed to the country following a deal struck between Syria and Western nations, accusing President Bashar al-Assad of using chemical weapons against rebel forces and innocent civilians fighting for regime change. The OPCW released a statement assuring that Syria is no longer in a position to conduct any further production or mixing of chemical weapons.
China and several Southeast Asian governments have demanded an explanation from the U.S. after reports in the German magazine Der Spiegel say American and Australian embassies in the region were used as secret hubs to collect electronic data. The reports, based on documents released by fugitive former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, come amidst an international outcry over allegations the U.S. has spied on the telephone communications of as many as 35 foreign leaders. Here's our Washington correspondent, Lorna Shattuck.
Der Spiegel describes a signals intelligence program called State Room, in which U.S., British, Australian and Canadian embassies house surveillance equipment to collect electronic communications. Those countries, along with New Zealand, make up the so-called Five Eyes, who all have an intelligence sharing agreement with the U.S. It says the operations in each embassy are small in size and staff, and their true mission isn't known by most employees at the embassies in question. China's said it's severely concerned about the reports and is demanding immediate clarification and explanation.
And spying programs are also affecting internet giants Google and Yahoo. Google says it's outraged by reports that the U.S. and British intelligence services have intercepted masses of data from its fiber optic communication cables abroad. New documents leaked from the NSA suggest they also penetrated data lines belonging to Yahoo. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
A top-secret document from January of this year, leaked to the Washington Post by whistleblower Edward Snowden, points to a joint program with Britain's government communications headquarters called Muscular, which intercepts hundreds of millions of records from Google and Yahoo by tapping into private fiber-optic networks. Google's chief legal officer responded with an unusually blunt statement, saying, "We are outraged at the lengths the government seems to have gone to intercept data from our private fiber networks, and it underscores the need for urgent reform."
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration has lifted their ban on the use of certain electronic devices during flights. The revision comes after an advisory panel determined that interference from electronic devices poses less of a threat to airplane operation than previously believed, making their usage safe and secure. Michael Huerta, head of the Federal Aviation Administration, announced the relaxation of the rules.
"I am pleased to announce that airlines can safely expand passenger use of portable electronic devices during all phases of flight.
Passengers are now free to use devices like tablets and e-readers during all stages of flight. However, the use of cell phones and laptops to make calls and connect to the internet is still restricted during takeoffs and landings." Ministers from seven African countries are meeting in New York to ask the United Nations to push for a deferral in the trial of Kenya's president. President Uhuru Kenyatta is charged by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity for the violence following Kenya's 2007 election in which 1,100 people died. Nick Harper reports from New York.
It's a day of meetings for Kenya's foreign minister, Amina Mohamed. She's in talks with delegates from six other African countries and the United Nations Security Council. Kenya wants the UN to delay the International Criminal Court's trial of Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, for 12 months. Kenya argues that he needs to focus on national affairs following the Al-Shabaab terrorist attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi. The African Union is also pushing for a delay, but the ICC has itself said on Thursday that they may be willing to delay Kenyatta's trial for a few months, so a deferral may be likely.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. China and several Southeast Asian governments are demanding an explanation from the US after reports that embassies in the region were used as part of a secret data collection program known as State Room. A German magazine is reporting that surveillance equipment was secretly housed in US, British, Australian and Canadian embassies, a group of countries with an intelligence sharing agreement called the Five Eyes. FSN's Lorna Shaddick has been speaking to James Lewis, Director of the Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for International and Strategic Studies, and began by asking him whether some might consider the Five Eyes an English-speaking spying club.
The French sometimes complain about it as sort of an Anglo-Saxon conspiracy, and there's a little bit of truth to that. It's very easy for these five countries to work together because they have a similar culture, similar political institutions, and similar foreign policies. There are frictions, of course, in any alliance, but there are fewer frictions in this one. It gave a global reach. It matched with the security interests of all the partners, and it allowed them to share knowledge and technology. Each country still has their own independent policies, but as a vehicle for cooperation, it's one of the best in the world.
And indeed, the Five Eyes have cooperated very closely with the US, in particular spying on Asia. Does that surprise you at all?
Well, the cooperation started against Nazi Germany in the Second World War, and now it looks at the security threats we all face today, which are primarily terrorism, but secondarily dealing with the growth of China. The Chinese are still maybe a little more Leninist in their thinking than would be best for a stable environment.
But is it perhaps a little bit of an overreach on the part of the US using these allies in such a way?
It's important to bear in mind that there's a difference between collection and read. You could say that the agencies were lazy and that they collected everything because that's easiest. What they actually read was a tiny fraction. You know what they're targeting. It might be North Korean proliferation, it might be Taliban in Pakistan. The number of people who are writing emails about that is very small, so I don't think it's an overreach. The Five Eyes share concerns about proliferation, about terrorism, about some of the emerging regional powers, and so it's easy for us to cooperate. Cooperation with Australia, for example, to prevent another Bali bombing, very useful to both sides.
The Obama administration's been quite vocal about how it's trying to pivot its foreign policy towards Asia. Mm-hmm. How are these allegations going to affect that?
Well, the U.S. is definitely on the defensive, and the U.S. will need to do some rebuilding. But at the end of the day, interests remain aligned, and that will lead us eventually, if we can ever manage to explain what we were doing and apologize for it, that will lead us back to largely where we were before. The one thing that has changed is that people who didn't realize how insecure the global telecommunications network is now should know that. And it's been portrayed in a way as only the U.S. does this. There are at least six countries in the world that can do exactly what the U.S. did. And they're doing it. We depend on an infrastructure that is fabulously insecure. That's the central problem. How can you run a business? How can you have an economy that depends on something that an energetic 15-year-old can break into? That's the big problem. And Snowden inadvertently has called attention to that.
The focus perhaps might shift now away from the U.S. to these Five Eyes.
I don't think so because, well, you know, we're the chief foreign devil, so people will continue to blame us. But in general, I think what it will shift away to is a realization that Russia, China, the U.S., the U.K., a couple of other countries are all doing this every day. And they're doing it because it's so easy. You could say, and I wouldn't object, we should have resisted the temptation to listen to Merkel's cell phone. I'm sorry, anybody using a commercial cell phone, especially a world leader, they shouldn't be surprised. And the U.S. was not the only country on that cell phone.
Which other countries were on it?
Well, the one I want to alienate at the moment would be Russia. If we can do it, the Russians can do it. The Russians are as good as we are. The British are as good as we are. People need to get over the Snowden revelations, which are intended to focus attention on the U.S. and realize this is how the world works. How do we make it better? And saying the U.S. should stop would mean that instead of five countries on your cell phone, there'd only be four.
Isn't that funny? Mr. Lewis, thank you very much indeed.
Certainly.
Unless Congress acts in the next 24 hours, a deep cut to the food stamp program will go into effect, reducing benefits for millions of low-income Americans and their children. The nearly $11 billion reduction is triggered by the expiration of the 2009 stimulus bill, which gave a boost to families struggling during the so-called Great Recession. Some progressive lawmakers are pushing an 11th-hour bill to undo the impending cuts, saying they would increase hunger in America and hurt a still shaky economy. But the measure isn't likely to make it through before Friday's deadline, and even deeper cuts could be on the horizon. Congress began a long-delayed conference this week on the farm bill, in which House Republicans are pushing to cut nearly $40 billion from an anti-hunger programs. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein reports.
January, we had the so-called fiscal cliff. This Friday, we have what some call the food stamp cliff. A scheduled cut of $5 billion this year and $11 billion over the next 3 years to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, commonly known as SNAP.
Shame on us. Shame on us.
That's Illinois Democrat Jan Schakowsky, one of nearly 40 House Democrats currently scrambling to pass the Extend Not Cut SNAP Benefits Act by Friday to undo these impending cuts. The expiration of the federal stimulus package is expected to reduce food stamp benefits to less than $1.40 per person per meal. At a conference this week, Schakowsky called this unacceptable and cited federal data on who uses the food stamp program.
One half of SNAP beneficiaries are children. 8% are seniors. 7% are our military veterans and their families. People that get the SNAP benefits are working people, and still they can't put food on the table. You know, most SNAP beneficiaries are on the program for less than a year. It's a trampoline that takes them to over a bad spot in their lives and enables them to get back on their feet.
But the bill remains stuck in committee as of late Thursday afternoon, leading many food stamp supporters, like Senate Democrat Tom Harkin of Iowa, to declare that it's too late.
You're going to have a lot of hungry kids. You're going to have a lot of people out of work that will not be able to. And our food banks are already inundated around this country. You call them, you talk to your food banks, they're, because a lot of the SNAP stuff runs out halfway through the month, and then they go to the food bank. Now, they won't even get 2 weeks or 3 weeks of food. This is not befitting a great nation. It's just not.
Harkin said he's focused now on preventing a much bigger cut to the program in the next farm bill. The House and Senate's conference on the farm bill started this week, and the main point of contention is not if, but rather how much to cut food stamps. House Republicans are seeking a $40 billion cut over a decade, which would cut out nearly 4 million people who currently depend on the assistance. It would also kick an additional 280,000 children out of free school lunch and breakfast programs, because children in SNAP households are automatically eligible for these meals. Some Democrats in the conference support cutting SNAP by about $4.5 billion, while others say there should be no cuts at all. Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro told reporters this week that other programs in the farm bill should be put on the chopping block first.
You keep in mind that even as these cuts are happening, wealthy farmers, agribusiness will continue to benefit from up to a $9 billion increase in the crop insurance program. The magnitude of the food stamp cuts occurring on Friday and being proposed in the farm bill are not just numbers. They have a real impact on people's lives, on children's lives, and children's development.
Nearly 50 million Americans currently depend on food stamps, a number that's climbed in recent years as wages stagnated and jobs disappeared during the recession. The Census Bureau estimates that the program kept nearly 4 million people out of poverty last year alone, and a study by Moody's Analytics found that it also helped the economy, as every dollar spent in SNAP benefits generated about $1.70 in economic activity. Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern, a designated member of the Farm Bill Conference Committee, promised this week to oppose the deep cuts sought by Republicans, even if the committee approves them.
Let's make it clear. We will not let a farm bill pass the House of Representatives or the United States Senate if it makes hunger worse in this country. We will fight back with every ounce of energy and strength that we have to make sure that we don't have a farm bill that increases hunger in America.
More farm bill meetings have not yet been set, but the president has called for the completion and passage of the bill by the end of the year. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, we've just had the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Sandy, the powerful storm that swept through the Caribbean and the eastern United States, killing over 200 people and causing billions of dollars of damage, much of that damage in New York City. As the city struggles to recover from Sandy, it also needs to prepare for the possibility of facing a similar storm in the future. From New York, Quinn Bowman has more.
Just over a year ago, Superstorm Sandy hit the east coast of the United States, leaving a trail of devastation in its wake. In the New York harbor, a 4-meter storm surge rendered low-lying areas helpless against flooding.
This storm in particular has a strong and lasting memory in New York City.
Thomas Sandler is an associate scientist at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. He remembers Sandy all too well. When some New York residents were without power for over a week, the subway system incurred significant damage and closed entirely for a few days, and many residents lost their homes and are still struggling to get back on their feet. So will New York be ready for the next Sandy? That depends on what you mean by ready.
I think a lot of it comes to the theme that you are your own first responder. People need to become more aware that in the first 1 to 2 to even 3 days of disaster, you're essentially going to be on your own.
Since last year, there have been improvements to the subway system and the power grid that should at least provide moderately better protection in the event of a similar storm. However, both are still vulnerable, and there are threats over which we have no control. Sea levels have been rising steadily, more than 30 centimeters in the last century, and warmer water temperatures as a result of climate change could increase the chances of unpredictable storms like Sandy. In a low-lying city like New York, there are some who believe that planning for the future requires a more radical approach.
We exist in the water surrounds us, and if we don't define a more beneficial relationship with it, you know, the city as we know it won't continue to exist.
Adam Urinsky's architecture firm initially reimagined New York City's waterfront area for a museum exhibition in 2010 and has been developing the project since that time. In the wake of Sandy, ideas like these have gained more attention and legitimacy.
There would be a series of breakwater islands ringing the tip of Manhattan that would prevent the force of a storm surge or blunt the force of a storm surge coming in from the Verrazano Narrows.
The next level would be wetlands that gradually give way to lower Manhattan, unlike the seawalls that currently exist, with any runoff floodwater being filtered back into the harbor. And finally, he believes that the buildings in flood-prone areas need to be built or retrofitted to simply deal with occasional flooding. He estimates the overall cost of the project to be in the neighborhood of $20 billion, a high price tag, but perhaps not when considering that estimates of the damage caused by Sandy are also in the same range.
New Yorkers have done great things in the past. We built one of the finest fresh water systems in the world that provides our drinking water. We've got Central Park. We can do this.
And while Urinsky is optimistic that New York City can move on, the thousands of people still struggling to recover from Sandy are a grim reminder of how high the stakes are. In any case, one thing is clear, the city of New York and the millions of people who live here will need to adapt to a future where storms even worse than Sandy are possible. Quinn Bowman, New York.
Army veteran Matt Zeller has finally completed his mission to bring his former Afghan interpreter, Janice Shinwari, to the United States. The two men have fought years of red tape and bureaucracy to get Janice out of Afghanistan, where he had been placed on a Taliban kill list. Earlier, I spoke to both men, but began by asking Matt how their strong bond was established.
Janice saved my life in a firefight in 2008 in a province called Ghazni, which is in Afghanistan. Basically, long story short, I was on a three-vehicle convoy on a patrol into a very remote part of the province when we got attacked and surrounded 45 members of the Taliban, probably about 45 of them versus the 15 of us. This mortar round landed about 2 to 3 meters away from me and sent me flying back into a ditch. A rescue convoy showed up, and Janice jumped out of the back of one of the vehicles and into this ditch that I had fallen into. And the next thing I know, he's firing his weapon at these two Taliban fighters who had rounded a corner. And if he hadn't been there, they would have shot me in the back, killing me instantly. I mean, at that point, you know, I wanted to know everything I could about him. I mean, we had literally just met a week ago. And so when my tour ended in December 2008, I promised him, I said, I'm going to do whatever I can in my life as possible to save your life and get you and your family out of this country and to America. And so for the last 5 years, I've been trying to just that. He deserves to be a citizen of this country and protect it.
And I understand that he's actually with you at the moment.
He's literally sitting next to me. Here he is.
Janice, hello. A fascinating story, an account of what seems to have been a very long, arduous, drawn-out battle to actually get to the United States. But if I can just take you back, Matt spoke about when you rescued these men, you saved his life, his words. But you had a long period between that event and touching down in Washington. What was life like for you, for your family in Afghanistan during that period?
As Zeller said, that in Afghanistan we had a very hard time, especially since 2009 when my name was added to the Taliban kill list. I spent most of my time at the interpreter's village, which was attached to Camp Black Horse. There was an American base in Kabul called Camp Black Horse. I spent most of my time in that village because of the Taliban. Called me many times and they told me that if they find me, they will kill me there. From that time, I was staying at the interpreter's village, and my family, my wife and my kids, they were staying with my father-in-law. In 2011, I applied for the special immigrant visa, SIV, to go to the United States because it was hard for me to live in the fear of Taliban. And in 2013, I got my approval that my case has been approved and I will have an interview. After my interview, I talked with my friend Zeller, my brother. I told him that I have a very hard time in Afghanistan. I passed my interview. I'm just waiting for my visa. And Zeller started helping me talk with many people. I got my visa after 2 months. It's very hard to get your visa after 2 months. And there are some people that they're waiting for years to get their visa and come to the United States. But I got my visa in 2 months. That was all Zeller's effort and help that I got my visa.
I should say, Janice didn't give me too much credit here. He had been waiting 2 years for the State Department to actually issue the visa. It took me 2 months of lobbying them basically on a daily basis, getting the media involved before they finally did the right thing. They only acted once they felt the pressure.
Matt, what do you think would have been Janice's fate had he stayed in Afghanistan?
Oh, he would have died. There's no question about it. The Taliban used to kidnap the interpreters around us, and when they would catch them, they would literally send us back the body parts of these people, their hands, their feet, sometimes their heads, and they would send it to our base wrapped in packages with letters basically saying, this is what happens to collaborators, this is what happens to traitors of Islam, which is what they call the interpreters, which is a huge, huge insult to them. Janice is a very good man and a good Muslim and a very peaceful man. And, you know, the whole point of doing this was to, one, kill these interpreters, which would hamper our efforts, but two, to send the message to all the translators still working for our forces, which was, this is what happens to those who help the Americans. And if he had stayed behind, his fate would have been the same of too many other interpreters who have been killed serving our military. You know, I don't just consider Janice my interpreter. I consider him a member of my unit. That's why I'm so thrilled. Because I'm telling you, this is a five-year sigh of relief that's finally come out of my body. He's the last member of my unit that was still serving at war, and he's finally done. His tour is over.
Matt Zeller and Janice Shinwari. And finally tonight, New York City has had an unusual visitor for the month of October. The world-famous British graffiti artist Banksy has spent the entire month using the city as a backdrop for his artwork. And while some New Yorkers are eagerly following his every move, others aren't quite as positive about his presence. Iris Spitzer has more from New York.
An unusual scene was unfolding outside an adult entertainment club around noon in Midtown Manhattan on a recent day. Crowds of people had gathered around a colorful piece of art on a metal roll-up door, all trying to get a look at the latest work by the most famous graffiti artist in the world. That would be Banksy, the England-based artist whose real identity remains a secret, who has been conducting a month-long residency throughout New York City. For fans of the subversive artist, looking at the stencil of a lonely man in a suit holding wilting flowers titled Waiting in Vain, just viewing the work has been an adventure.
And you really got to find out what those things are, race to them, take the pictures, you know, and start talking to people, you know, enjoy the area, because I think it all just adds to the whole ambiance of the single piece.
I think he's brilliant, and even though he's kind of mocking us in a way.
Banksy first rose to prominence over 10 years ago in England when his work started appearing around Bristol and London. A few years later, his work was selling for six figures at Sotheby's auction house. He made a feature film called Exit Through the Gift Shop, and all the while, his real name and image remained a mystery. He's titled his New York work Better Out Than In and announces the new pieces daily through his Instagram page. Every time a new Banksy piece has sprung up here in New York City, a crowd has formed, usually within the hour, but not everyone is so excited about Banksy's presence.
He's not from New York. He's not even from the United States. So what happens is that, you know, coming from Europe, I believe that there's still this negative image, these negative stereotypes of the Bronx.
Ruben Diaz Jr. is the president of the Bronx, one of the five boroughs that make up New York City. Diaz is upset about a Banksy piece that turned up a few days ago in the South Bronx that incorporates the phrase ghetto for life. The Bronx that Diaz wants to talk about is the place with a revitalized economy, green buildings, and an upcoming restaurant week. And while art critics may argue that the image viewed in its entirety, showing a butler holding a tray of spray cans for a young, well-dressed Caucasian graffiti artist, is insightful social commentary, Diaz isn't buying it.
I get where the message is trying to go, but just the wording was ill-advised, and we're just trying to walk away from this, you know, and do something different from the stereotypes of the 70s and the 80s.
As with many of the sites of Banksy's New York works, the owners of the defaced buildings sprang into action to protect the work because it might be worth a lot of money to them somehow, in this case, covering it with a locked metal gate. In fact, the show, which is slated to run through the end of October, has already provided its share of surreal Banksy moments. Local residents charging viewing fees to curious onlookers, threats from the New York Police Department, and a street vendor stall selling original Banksys unbeknownst to passersby. Ira Spitzer, New York.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our program by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Friday, Nigeria's bloody battle with Boko Haram extremists. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Rebecca Foster. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.